This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Enough with the fake modesty. Come on.
Well, it may be fake, but the discomfort is real.
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at fordhaminstitute.org. Now, please welcome my special guest for this week, Andrew Campanella. Andrew, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much, Mike, and everybody else. I appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Yeah, also joining us as always, my co-host, David Griffith.
Hey, Mike, always a pleasure.
Yeah, so Andrew, back again for National School Choice Week. Andrew, of course, is the president of National School Choice Week. We have had fun with talking to you about that title over time. We also talk about how you just reappear this time of year. You're almost like the early groundhog.
Punxsutawney Andrew of School Choice Week, and every year I manage to see my shadow.
I was just going to say that, but it felt mean for
now
me to
I'll
say
take
it, so I'm glad you said it.
If you see your shadow, does that mean what? We're going to have another good legislative session
another year of school choice?
It means more families will access their options this year than at any other time in history, which seems to be the trend that I could say every year.
That is the trend. Well, hey, it's great to have you with us. We are going to talk about National School Choice Week and also a great new study out from Fordham on the topic of school choice. Let's do that in Ed Reform Update. All right, Andrew. Well, we have had you on most years, I think. It's almost an annual tradition. Remind us, how long has National School Choice Week been around and what's happening this time around?
Sure. We've been around since 2011, and 2022 is going to be a special year for us. We have lots of events and activities planned all across the country. 26,000 schools of all types are planning open houses, school fairs, information sessions to raise awareness. And we have worked all year round on developing the nation's largest portfolio of school search resources for parents, broken down by specific states. It's practical, jargon-free, easy-to-use information that parents can use all year round, but we hope they use it this month if they want to make a change for their kids' school for the next school year, because if they get started now, they'll have enough time.
Yeah, that's great. And that is a good point. The clock is a ticking. You know, one of the things we've talked about over the years, Andrew, is I always love how under your leadership, National School Choice Week is so positive. I think you and I both share a frustration that sometimes some of our friends who advocate for school choice have this tendency to go negative, to say, well, the best way we're going to promote school choice is by attacking traditional public schools and helping people see how terrible those public schools are. And that's going to make them turn to school choice. It doesn't really make sense from a basic political arithmetic. There's way more people who choose traditional public schools.
Right. And it doesn't make sense regardless of what type of math you use, whether it's new math or old math. There are still more traditional public schools out there than any other type of school. And when we talk to parents, we just did a survey and got results a few days ago. We asked them, in considering schools for your children, and 51% of parents said that they looked at different schools for their kids for this school year. What types of schools did you consider or will you consider? The highest percentage of parents said they looked at traditional public schools, followed by private schools, followed by public schools in different districts, charter schools, online schools, homeschooling, and magnet schools. I think being positive and inclusive and embracing all options really reflects the way parents view school choice, not as this fight to the death between different types of schools, but rather an array of options that they can choose from to find the right fit for their kids.
That's right. And look, I think we know that parents, to choose a different school, especially if you're not just, say, a kid's entering pre-K or entering kindergarten or entering middle school or high school, but to make a change, you know, in the middle of elementary school, in the middle of high school, it's usually because something has gone wrong. Right. And it could be for the school, right? Certainly this pandemic has been one thing, right? Suddenly your school is not in session and they're doing remote learning. Could be it's just not working for your kid. You know, they are a square peg in a round hole and they just need something different, right? So it's understandable if it's one thing to say, hey, some parents are feeling frustrated that the system, the traditional public school system, is not more responsive to their needs, the needs of their kids. Understandable. But again, that's a different thing than trying to constantly make this case of, hey, let us argue about how terrible these schools are that, by the way, most parents choose and, you know, that many other Americans have warm feelings about, you know, from their time as parents or grandparents or students themselves. Now, to that point, we are proud at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute that we have been digging into the question of the impact of school choice on traditional public schools, because we really think that is now one of the remaining big questions left. And we know that the opponents of school choice, they use this all the time. They say, well, whether school choice helps kids that are actually partaking, it's leaving other kids behind. Sure, you're using a rescue boat approach and the kids left behind on the Titanic are sinking, or whatever that argument is, right? And we want to know, is that true? Or is school choice a rising tide that lifts all boats? And our own David Griffith has a new study out that we're very proud of that digs into this question. It's a bit of a sequel to a previous one that you did. David, you know, in like 13 words or less, can you tell us about the study?
Well, Mike, the title is like 13 words. So let me start there.
Okay, well, then that's all you get. That's it.
Yeah. The title of the study is Still Rising, Charter School Enrollment and Student Achievement at the Metropolitan Level. And as that title suggests, what's new about this study, or the reason we did it, is that we are looking at the effects of increases in charter enrollment citywide or countywide or you name it at the
metro sort of large,
wide. At the yeah. metro wide, yes. And really looking at these impacts at a community level, or if you prefer a market level. And, you know, I'll give away some of the ending here, right? The strongest finding that we get is that increases in charter school enrollment are associated with significant declines in racial and socioeconomic achievement gaps at the metro level, particularly in math. And, you know, that's something that has perhaps been implicit in almost every charter study that's ever been done, but it is rarely explicit. And so, you know, I think that ultimately the study addresses pretty directly some of the lingering concerns that some people still have that charters are creating a more unequal system. We find that basically the opposite of that, the system becomes more equal.
It's so powerful and in line with so many other studies that have looked at this question around competitive effects or spillover effects. Now, what's new about this is that we do it at the metro level. Of course, that's important because in some places, think about a place like Phoenix, you know, you've got these districts divvied up into all these weird lines and kids are crossing districts all the time. Plus they're going to charter schools, plus they're going to private school. I mean, it's a real market. And this tries to capture all of that in one place. And it's narrowing achievement gaps, which is huge. You know, on the private school choice side, I'd say, Andrew, we don't have as strong evidence on achievement for the kids in private school choice programs, at least on test scores, better outcomes for long-term outcomes. But again, you've got studies at the private school choice side showing positive competitive effects. In other words, the strongest research we've got, and we had Pat Wolf on to talk about the school choice research, it's again and again and again, is that it actually, what's most clear is that it helps the kids who do remain in traditional public schools. So if those are the kids you care about the most, then, you know, you should be a huge supporter of school choice.
Exactly. And I think you should be a huge supporter of school choice across the spectrum. And that includes specific school choice policies that would actually increase enrollment at and funding for district schools, open enrollment. Mm-hmm. Only 11 yeah. states have robust open enrollment programs that allow parents to choose any school in any district. Parents want those programs. And if more states expanded them, that would create a much more competitive environment mm-hmm. for traditional district schools than they currently experience. You can't bellyache about competition when you're not putting forth your best effort at actually competing. And I think mm-hmm. I have a lot of faith in a lot of traditional public schools in their ability to compete and succeed in attracting students if only parents were given those options.
So, you know, the one lingering question for both of you, Andrew and David, is to continue to try to understand how to explain these positive competitive effects. I mean, we always had the theory forever. I mean, going back to Milton Friedman, that as Andrew, you just said, that competition is something that's healthy and in other sectors leads to better outcomes. Is it that simple? A lot of people have said, well, it's different in education because it's not, let's be honest, a real market. It's, you know, a political economy. There's all these political restraints, especially on the traditional public schools. So what is it? What do we think is happening out there?
You want to take that one? I'm going to give you an annoying researcher's answer, Mike. I have thought about this so much, and I am not a whole lot wiser. I got to be honest with you. There are smart people who believe in several compelling theories of what's going on, right? It may simply be that parents know what's best for their kid. And yeah, I can see Andrew nodding, right? I mean, and that is a compelling theory. And that probably explains some of what we're going on. It's mm-hmm. literally just, you know, the parent knows better than the system does exactly what the kid needs. And, you know, if you connect the kid with the school that the kid needs, then, you know, the kid does better. I mean, it's not,
yep.
you could make a counter argument, but ultimately it's not a rocket science notion here. On top of that, you know, we all know that everybody works a little harder, right? And tries a little harder when there's real competition. And so I think it's pretty clear. And at the institutional level, change is more likely when there's real pressure. So I think there's some of that going on. But, you know, it is really complicated, Mike. It is legitimately complicated. I'm not going to give you a sort of back of the envelope answer to that one.
Yep. Andrew?
I think that you're onto something big there, because what we have heard time and time again from opponents of school choice is that when you introduce more options, students who are the most successful will leave. We've always said, well, that doesn't make any logical sense. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't choose something different if you're happy with what you have and you're succeeding there. So my thought is that the reason we're seeing growth in traditional district schools and growth in achievement in charter schools when there is that competition and there are those different options is because students who weren't succeeding in one environment are going to an environment that is a better fit. As a result, the students who were successful in traditional public schools are still there, and the students who weren't successful have moved. They're getting an education that best meets their needs in the charter school, and everybody is rising. Mm-hmm. Really flies in the face of the longstanding myth that charter schools cream from the top the best kids in traditional district schools.
Yeah, and let me just say one more sort of hook for the study here, Mike, that I think relates to that. Some of the strongest results are for Hispanic students. And mm-hmm. this is a really, you know, unique population, right? You've got kids where English may not be the first language that's spoken at home. They may still be learning academic English. Those kids have unique needs, right? That could go overlooked for entirely understandable reasons in a classroom or a system that is designed with other students' needs in mind. And I'm not sort of trying to blame the teacher, right? Or the principal, but this notion that one school or one classroom can meet every kid's individual specific needs, no matter what shape or size they are, is asking an awful lot of teachers. It's asking an awful lot of schools. And it's when push comes to shove, it's not necessary. It's not something that has to be a feature of the system. We can give parents and teachers and schools, we can empower them to tailor their education a little better. So I just wanted to flag that. That was something that stood out yep. to me. It's something I've thought about a lot.
All right. We will have to leave it there. But thank you again, Andrew Campanella, president of National School Choice Week. Enjoy National School Choice Week, Andrew, and everybody else.
Thank you.
We'll see you when you come out of your cave a year from now.
I'll see you in 12 months.
Okay, everybody. Hey, now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Hey there, Mike.
So, you know, I don't care how good this Research Minute is going to be or how great this study is going to be. It cannot be any better than the study we just discussed, which, of course, is our very own David Griffiths.
Whoop, whoop. Indeed.
I really hate it when you do that.
Why? Enough with the fake modesty. Come on.
Well, it may be fake, but the discomfort is real.
It's like when my sixth grade teacher called me out in front of all the other sixth graders for having the one good essay about sixth grade camp when everybody else turned in a poorly done essay. It was both the proudest and worst day of my life. So
really? You didn't there like you the go. Limelight as a youngster? I find that hard to believe.
Okay, but sixth grade, let's take us back a little bit to a time when perhaps being known as Mr. Smarty Pants was not
was not cool. All
what right. you were looking for. Right. Right. So
that's good stuff.
All right. Well, what do you have for us, Amber?
All right. We have a new NBER study that examines the effects of school and childcare disruptions during the pandemic. Sorry, there are still lots of pandemic studies on low-income parents and children's mental and emotional health.
Sounds like an upper.
Woo. The study focused on hourly service workers in a large U.S. city who had children aged 2 to 7. These workers presumably have less stable work situations, which makes it harder to balance work and the demands of schooling or childcare. I've got to spend a little bit of time talking about the sampling approach because it's pretty hardcore. Analysts use what's known as a venue-based sampling approach to access hard-to-reach populations. They generated a complete list of venues in the food service, retail, and hotel business industries in this large city using, quote, Earth Institute data. Then they constructed a sampling frame by venue, by day, and by time, which is VDTs, apparently, randomly selecting from these VDTs and systematically identifying and recruiting eligible individuals present in those locations. So it's basically the best they can do to get a representative sample of hourly service workers with young kids in this major city. Study staff literally visited each business aiming to identify all workers who met the sampling criteria who were at work at that time by approaching workers at each business, determining whether they were eligible and asking them to direct them to other workers currently eligible who were also at work. Each participant was asked to participate in a 30-day continuous wave of data collection occurring sometime between September 20th and January 2021. Their sample included almost 700 people with roughly 17,000 person days for analysis. Each day, respondents answered a series of simple questions via text message at the same time every day, which helps to reduce recall bias. And they received monetary incentives for completion. 90% of participants answered at least half of these daily surveys. Okay, what did we ask them?
So you're basically saying this was like a hack job then, you know, as studies go, right?
Who does this? Right?
That is incredible. How much did the study cost?
That's what I'm wondering.
Really impressive. Especially the in-person part. Of course, I hope there was no super spreading going on. This was in the part of the pandemic before we had any vaccines. But I'm sorry. Go ahead, Beth.
All right. We digress. All right. What did they ask them? They asked whether their child was enrolled in remote schooling or in-person school or childcare. They asked about their race. Then they asked Likert scale type questions about whether childcare or school went smoothly that day. Gave them examples like, did it start on schedule? Did your internet work? About whether their child was uncooperative today. If their child was worried or sad. If the parent was fretful, angry, irritable, or anxious. If the parent slept okay. How hard or easy it was to support their child that day, and whether they punished their child that day. They used descriptive statistics and regression models with family fixed effects. Descriptively, half of the parents were Black, 22% were Hispanic, 18% were white. Mean age of parents was 31. They were 84% female. Modal education was high school education. Mean income was roughly $2,100 per month. Remote-only education was reported by 44% of the sample, 33% report hybrid, 13% report in-person, school, or childcare. Across the month of surveys, disruptions were common. Got to give you a quiz, come on. With how many of respondents reporting at least one day when school or childcare did not go as planned? What do you think?
Over a month?
Over a month. How many percentage report that at least one day it didn't go as planned?
And which month was it?
It was September. What did I just say?
September.
It was September. Oh my gosh, David.
I don't care. It's still 85%. I'm going to go with 85%.
All right, Mike, what are you going to say?
Look, I'd go as close to 100% as possible. Everybody must have had disruptions at least once, right?
All right. 77% reported at least one day. It didn't go as planned. 74% say at least one day when it was difficult to support learning. The share of days that school or childcare did not go as planned was about a quarter. So then, okay, disruptions were most common for children in remote learning, 24% of days. But in-person learning was 18% of days, so not that big of a difference. Hispanics reported the highest frequency of disruption and difficulty supporting learning. A school or childcare disruption on any given day increased the share of children who were uncooperative, according to their parents, some or a lot, by 9.1 percentage points. It also similarly increased the probability that the child was sad or worried, some or a lot that day. Disruptions also strongly impacted daily parent mood, increasing by 12.7 percentage points the share of parents who said they feel irritable, angry, or anxious. Here, effects were even higher for white parents, hard to say why. Parent sleep difficulty also rose significantly the night after a disruption to school or childcare, and they were more likely to lose their temper with their child on a day with a disruption and also to punish their child. Effects were large and significant for all races. I think if we didn't suspect it already, the study illustrates the toll that the pandemic has taken on parents and kids.
So can we say anything about the modality in terms of sort of was fully remote more stressful and bad for emotional health on the parents and the kids or not necessarily?
We definitely saw more. I don't think they did the cut by disruption by modality. Disruption's most common. You're talking about the emotional part.
I guess I'm
of
just trying to understand, like, I mean, I understand that disruption, whatever it means, right? I mean, it is a problem. But, you know, remote learning in general seemed to be such a tougher situation for parents who have to go work outside the home to deal with. We're used to so many of these studies now telling us, like, things have been really bad in the last 2 years, especially for kids who are fully remote. But this study doesn't exactly make that conclusion.
It mainly talks about, I actually don't have it written down, but I think I remember that they didn't see a difference by modality with some of these behavioral and emotions. Mm-hmm. The big headline for them, I think, was that disruptions were more common in remote. But if you ask me, you know, 24% a day versus 18% of days for in person wasn't as big of a gap as I would have expected.
Well, and I'm trying to picture, you know, who was home with the kids when they were fully remote, right?
If these parents were working. I'm trying to understand what we mean by disruption in a remote setting.
They gave the example of internet not working or not starting on time.
I don't know. It sort of misses the point, at least for me. We've been talking about disrupted learning in terms of remote instruction for the better part of a year, I feel like, right? And then we're asking whether the disrupted learning is disrupted. I don't know. I mean, I'm sorry. I have a very cynical take on remote learning.
We got a descriptive on how many were in it, right? I mean, we already, 44% were, we already got that in terms of how many kids were experiencing what modality.
Yeah. It's odd to me to compare disruption or to average across disruption in two such different settings, right? Mm-hmm. My assumption about what learning looks like in a school is just so different from whatever it is I'm supposed to be picturing for remote. I don't know what I'm supposed to be picturing.
Can we also keep in mind this is a survey on a text message?
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So they didn't have a lot. These are like, you know, pretty simple questions they're asking folks. They have to respond same to every day, you know. So I don't know. I don't know if you guys have ever taken a survey on a text. I have, but you don't have a lot of room.
Yeah. And one more, I can't remember now. Were all these parents working during the day? I mean, is that part of the study that they went during the day to find them or not necessarily?
Right. They were working during the day. That's right.
They were.
If they had gone at 2 a.m., I think they actually did report on weekends. I just don't remember.
Yeah.
I don't remember what they said.
Well, again, I mean, this is related to my other questions. You know, how did these parents manage dealing with remote learning?
Right.
And it could be that, you know, their shift was not during the school day. So they were there with their child during the school day. And then they, you know, they were working at night and whatever their babysitting situation was previously that made it work. I mean, look, I can understand that if you have figured out, like, you're like, okay, we are doing remote learning now for the next 4, 5, 6 months, which is sort of what we knew, you know, then you can make plans around that. It's actually still quite disruptive. You know, if you're actually sending your kid to in-person school, but, you know, suddenly they close school a bunch. You know, it's like having a snow day, but instead of a few times a winter, it's like, you know, every couple of weeks.
Right.
That is tough to manage. Anyways, but if the major message is that this has been very tough, especially on working parents and working class parents, I think we would all agree.
I feel like we're stalling because we don't want to talk about what we should do to fix this.
Oh, okay. What should we do to fix it? Like end the pandemic?
Yeah. Right.
Is that what you mean, David? Is that it?
I don't know what I mean.
Well, it makes me wonder, you know, what it's like in normal times. And I think some of these findings, and you're right, Amber, it's just a text message survey, but you know, that these disruptions lead, makes everybody grouchy, and that maybe leads to parenting that parents aren't super proud of. And, you know, understanding all of that is interesting.
Are you telling us you understand it, Mike?
Let me tell you, I find my children to be much more cooperative when they are not with me.
It's hilarious on a full night's sleep.
Yes,
and the sleep matters too. All right. Well, I don't know. It's an amazing study. It sounds like an expensive study. I'm not entirely sure what we're supposed to make of it. That's not sort of, I don't know, common sense.
That we didn't already know. Yeah, right, that I get
this
that part.
Has really been tough. Okay, well, that is all the time that we've got. So until next week.
I'm David Griffith.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at fordhaminstitute.org.